You ready to start? Okay. Just like to welcome everybody out. My name's Todd Huntington. I'm the vice chairman filling in for Kevin Albrecht. He's in Washington State working on some forest fires up there. So I hate it when he does that to me. But just by way of procedure reminders, if you have a comment that you'd like to make, please fill out one of these yellow cards and bring it up to myself or Chris, and we'll call you up then when it's your turn. If you're representing yourself, you get 3 minutes. If you're representing an organization, you get five. Is that right or is it backwards? I think that's right. So we'll begin with our first, we need to approve the agenda. Anybody have any problems with the agenda?
I'll move to approve the agenda.
We have a motion by Wayne to approve the agenda. Do we have? Do you want to include the minutes also, Wayne? I don't remember getting the minutes. Okay.
I'm okay with including the minutes.
Okay, we'll include the minutes as well. Do we have a second?
Second.
Second by Chris. All in favor? Any opposed? That was unanimous. Chris, the Wildlife Board meeting update, since Kevin's not here and I wasn't at that one either.
Good evening. I'll try to give an update from our Wildlife Board meeting that took place on June 5th. It seems like a long time ago, but I'll do the best that I can. The turkey management plan was accepted and approved as presented by the division. The turkey transplant proposed list was also approved. They did add six sites that the Southern Region recommended. They added Marysville Canyon, Birchville, City Creek, Mammoth Creek, and the upper stretches of the Sevier, Minersville, and Coal Creek. The upland game, turkey and crane, three recommendations passed unanimously. And the use of game birds rule amendment passed unanimously. The last two items entailed the waterfowl recommendations, which included allowing a crow hunt in Utah. At the meeting on June 5th, there was quite a bit of discussion. A lot of people attended, both from the sportsman's side and a lot of the non-consumptive, the bird watchers, attended. Several hours of comments. The Wildlife Board ended up passing the division's recommendations 3-2. And then just yesterday, there's an ability for people to appeal, maybe that's not the word, but to appeal a Wildlife Board decision and have a rehearing. And so that's what, we'd never seen that before as a state agency, but the rule allows that to happen. And so the bird watchers, the non-consumptive, those who were against the crow hunt appealed it. And there was another hearing yesterday that got a lot of publicity in the news, and again, a lot of people attended that. We had several hours of comments, and what they ended up, the Wildlife Board ending up, there was a motion to vote on that specific item into two different groups, one to take it look at it from a sport hunting perspective, and then from a depredation hunt perspective. And Dr. King made a motion to separate them. And that motion was approved, and so they voted on the depredation hunt, and that passed 5-0. So there were, a depredation hunt was allowed, or the previous board decision stands. And then they voted on the sport hunt, and that again passed 3-2. So that's what happened at yesterday's hearing. And then on June 5th, at the Wildlife Board meeting, they also, the Utah Trial Hunter Program was approved and passed unanimously. At our RAC, and I mentioned this in an email to all the RAC members a month or so ago, or I believe it was right before this June 5th Wildlife Board meeting, so the first part of June. And I apologize for this, but as a division, I felt like we didn't understand exactly what the RAC's role was in pertaining to this Utah Trial Hunter Program. This was a law that the legislature voted for and approved. And so it wasn't the RAC's role to approve or reject this Utah Trial Hunter Program, but rather it was the RAC's role to shape it and to move the program within certain sideboards that the legislature that the legislative code had already been written for and set up. And so, as an agency, I apologize for not making that more clear. I feel that wasn't clear from my voice and also in the presentation. So, if you remember, our RAC rejected that the Utah Trial Hunter Program. I can't remember the vote, but we rejected that, and really, it wasn't appropriate for our RAC to reject it. Rather, we were supposed to shape it, and I apologize for not understanding that role more clearly. So the Wildlife Board, and after our RAC, they made adjustments to the presentation, and that role was better defined in the other three RAC meetings throughout the state, and the Wildlife Board certainly understood the role, and the Wildlife Board approved it unanimously. Any questions? Okay.
Thanks, Chris. I think you're up next for the regional update.
All right, it's been a good summer. We've been working real hard. All of our sections have had some great projects and some great things going on. I'll just touch briefly on all the sections and some of the projects they've been working on. Our aquatics sections just finished surveying some of the lakes in the LaSalle's. We haven't done that in several years, so that was a good thing to get out there and look at some of the lakes and see what kind of fish are growing in the various waters. We've also been working on some of our endangered fish, the bluehead suckers, or our sensitive fish. The bluehead suckers we've been taking out of Farron Creek. We'll later take them out of Millsite Reservoir. The purpose of that is to supplement the population in the San Rafael River. Some of these fish, the sensitive fish, have suffered because of from the Sealy fire, some of the runoff and the high sediment loads and the water conditions and the water quality that have come from the Sealy fire have affected some of the sensitive fish in the lower San Rafael. And so because of that, we're taking some of the fish from Farron Creek and Millsite and supplementing the population there. We also have a new a trap at our Duck Fork Reservoir that we've just tested out this year, and it's been very, very successful. We've caught twice the amount of eggs that we usually catch, or we catch fish in the trap and then we process the eggs, and we have twice as many eggs as we usually have. So it's been very successful that way. Those eggs are going to our hatchery. Conservation outreach has been very busy. We've had several fishing events. There's a free fishing day in June. We also work with the Forest Service and some other partners and host a special needs fishing day in Carbon County. We had a kids fishing day, and then in a few weeks we'll have a fishing event at the Carbon County Fairgrounds. We also have several archery events going on. We had one in Moab that was very successful. It's a family archery hunt or a family archery event where families come to the indoor archery range and learn how to shoot archery, bows and arrows. And so that was very successful. We've also been to several camps. It's that time of year we have girls camps and Boy Scout camps and youth camps. And Brent and his team have been out there working and doing archery events and wildlife education events. We had our Bighorn Sheep Watch. We also had several birding groups working with the Moab Birding Group, both at the Matheson Wetland Preserve and also at Desert Lake. And then most recently, we had a bat night, and we had about 15 people come from all over Utah. And with our sensitive species biologists, they caught bats and learned about bat biology. Our habitat section has been doing some great stuff. Of course, this time of year, we're managing our wildlife management areas. Some of those wildlife management areas like Nash Wash, or the Cunningham Ranch area, and then our Gordon Creek area, as well as some acres of Desert Lake and our Huntington Game Farm. We have water rights where we actively grow crops for the benefit of wildlife. So you see that lower right-hand pictures. That's what that is a picture of. We had a prescribed burn at our Cold Spring Wildlife Management Area up on the Tavaputs. The plan was to burn over 1,000 acres on our property, a division property, and on two different private landowners' properties. The good news is that we got fire on the ground. The bad news is that we only burned 270 acres. We'd like to have burned much more, but we rely on resources from the Forest Service and the BLM and Forestry, Fire, and State Lands, and getting us all together. And a lot of their work is volunteer work or donating to our agency. We usually have a very short window, a burn window, and it depends on fuel moisture levels and things like that. So we usually have a very short window to burn. In this case, we had 2 or 3 days. Winds picked up one day. They had to stop. But we did burn 270 acres, so that was exciting. And that adds to some of the acres that we had burned, I think, 3 years prior. The several years before this year, the last 2 years, we weren't even able to burn at all. So prescribed fire can be very tricky because it's hard. You have to get the right prescription. The fuel levels have got to be right. The weather's got to be right. And the scheduling with the helicopter who helps light the fire, that's all got to work in there as well. So, but this year we had 270 acres burned, so it was good. In that same area up on Cold Spring, we've done some aspen work, more mechanical work. We're building an exclosure, kind of to see whether we need to. We're putting an exclosure in an area that we seeded, and comparing it to an area that we didn't seed to see whether we need to invest seed in the future on those areas. Tomorrow we're going on a field tour. Everyone here is invited. We're meeting at 7 o'clock at our division office, 7 a.m. The local sage grouse working group. We'll be touring the Tavaputs Plateau, specifically Butch and Jeannie Jensen's property, and look at some of their habitat treatments they have up there for sage grouse. Our law enforcement officers have been busy. As you probably saw in the news, the Rainbow Coalition had a big party here in Utah, their annual event. They chose to have it over near Heber City. We sent law enforcement officers up to that area to support local sheriffs and other officers in that efforts. We recently, our three of our officers have gone through first responder training courses, and so they're even more qualified than ever to help on community needs where you need first responders. And then a few of our officers have recently gotten back from a conference in Reno, Nevada, where they attended the North American Wildlife Enforcement Officers meeting. So, and finally, our wildlife section. July is the month where we classify elk, so our biologists have been on all of our mountains and areas where we have elk and have been doing some classifications. Our sensitive species biologist, Tony Wright, and his crew have been out last month trapping burrowing owls and helping with that research. And then our biologists have also been on the Monroe Mountain in the southern region helping out with a pretty important deer study, a fawn survival study and a coyote study. Looking at fawn survival and coyotes and densities and how they relate to each other. So everyone's been working really, really hard, and it's been a really great summer so far. And if you have any questions, I'll try to answer them. Okay.
Thanks, Chris. Our action items, turkey depredation rule, Jason Robinson.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Jason Robinson, Upland Game Coordinator for the Utah Division of Wildlife out of the Salt Lake office. I'm going to be talking about turkey depredation rule 657-69. So just a little bit of background before we get into the actual rule. Turkeys were extirpated from many areas in the U.S. Turkey numbers were at their lowest in the 1930s. Evidence shows that wild turkeys are native to Utah. There's pictographs, petroglyphs, archaeological evidence. So a couple of those photos are, pictographs you can see look very similar to turkey prints. Reintroduction efforts in Utah started as early as the 1920s, and aggressive and more successful efforts began in 1989. Turkey populations are now doing very well. And one of the things we wanted to kind of point out is this is really a true wildlife success story, both for the country as well as for Utah. But with those growing turkey populations, it's created some areas with human-turkey conflicts. Last RAC meeting, I presented the Wild Turkey Management Plan. It was approved by the board here in June. And goal B under that management plan is to minimize human-wild turkey conflicts, and specifically to decrease the number of chronic material damage complaints by 25%. Again, a little bit more background. A year and a half ago, Bill 342 was passed, Wild Turkey Management, which created Utah Code 2317.5.1, which essentially requires the DWR to investigate and mitigate material damage to private property caused by wild turkeys. The division will respond within 72 hours of receiving a complaint with a variety of options to deal with those, including hazing, transplants, and additional hunts. That law gives rulemaking authority to the Wildlife Board to administer provisions related to private property damage. So essentially what this is, it's real similar to the Trial Hunter program. The state legislature passed a law, and what we're trying to do is create a rule that gives us more detail and more usability to this law, which is the proposed rule I have here for you tonight, which is 657-69. So within this rule, if a turkey causes material damage to private property, the property owner reports it to the Division of Wildlife. Material damage is defined as physical impacts to private property caused by turkeys that are visible, persistent, and detrimental to the landowner or lessee of the private property. The Division of Wildlife will respond within 72 hours of receiving that complaint. And at that point, the division may remove the turkeys from the property or implement a damage mitigation and prevention plan that would be approved by the landowner and the division, with the landowner signing that plan. So within that turkey damage mitigation and prevention plan, the division may provide educational materials about turkeys. They may haze the turkeys off the property.
Sorry.
Oh, no problem. Exclude the turkeys using fences, tarps, or other materials. Capture and relocate the turkeys. Allow additional harvest through limited entry or general season permits. Could increase number or areas. Enroll the property in walk-in access or the CWMU program. Offer depredation hunts for the area. Offer control permits to the landowner, or offer control permit vouchers to the landowner, and I'll go into a little more detail of what those are. So capture and relocate is probably going to be the primary tool we use at this point. You remember from the last RAC meeting, we approved 231 sites statewide to move turkeys. So we have a lot of areas that we can still grow turkey populations here in the state, so we can take those from areas where they may be causing problems to areas where they're less likely to cause problems. Capture and relocation is an effective tool. It's been very successful. We know that if we put turkeys in the right habitat, they do well. And again, we're still trying to grow the turkey population. However, it doesn't work in all situations. So we need to have additional tools available to us and to the landowner. So we could offer a depredation hunt, which is a focused response to verified reports of material damage. These hunts are in small areas with short notice and limited number of permits. The hunters would be selected from a hunter depredation pool. Essentially, if a hunter is interested, they apply online to be eligible for this, and then they would be selected randomly as these hunts are needed. That person must have a valid hunting or combination license to participate, and then they must also purchase a turkey permit. DWR regional supervisor would approve the boundaries, season dates, bag limits, sex of the turkeys to be harvested, allowable weapons, etc. Control permits for turkeys may be part of the damage mitigation and prevention plan. There would be a maximum of 2 control permits per calendar year. These permits would be for the landowner or leasee or their immediate family or employee. These permits are free to the landowner and is valid for one either sex turkey on the private property. Control permit vouchers also might be part of the damage mitigation and prevention plan. The division may issue vouchers for up to 10% of the documented turkeys on the private property with a maximum of 15 vouchers per calendar year. For landowner leasees or designated third-party recipients, so the landowner or their family, or they can provide that voucher to a third party that isn't related to them. A landowner may not gain financial. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I just was looking at this. It says 10% of the documented turkeys on private property with a maximum of 15 vouchers. Do you have places where there are 150 turkeys on private property?
There's areas in the northern part of the state where we've documented up to 400 on one landowner's property. So we wanted to give that landowner the ability to harvest enough birds that it'll get them off of the property and back onto either forest or state land. So, yes, we do have areas where we're probably not in this part of the state that I'm aware of, but other parts of the state. And then, again, a landowner may not gain financial compensation for the voucher's use. A voucher allows a holder to purchase a control permit. That person must have a valid hunting or combination license to redeem the voucher. Each control permit is valid for one either sex turkey on the private property. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thanks, Jason. Are there any questions from the RAC?
There's been a variety. Usually it's getting into to hay or something like that. And if you get a high concentration through a month or two, they may scratch and break the bells open to get at the grain or other things. That seems to be the most common, but it is rare. It's pretty rare to have turkey depredation issues.
Any other questions?
I mean, I guess just to comment, just to solidify, so your first thing would be to capture and relocate, because I guess being from this area, I mean, I think in general we see a lack of turkeys. I mean, we have areas where we transplant turkeys into and they disappear if we keep putting them in there. I know Turkey Federation keeps putting them in, for example, Pat Creek, and so to me it seems odd that now we're talking about putting out depredation tags. So that's the first line of defense, to capture and relocate.
We would probably try and educate the landowner, trying to increase the tolerance for turkeys, first of all, and then probably haze would be the next step, and then a trap and transplant. We want to try and move the birds because we have so many areas,
right.
This part of the state being an area.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
Questions from the audience. This is time for questions, and then if we have next will be comments, so this time's questions. No questions. Comments? So we didn't get any cards in on this particular item. Okay, comments from the rack. And or a motion. Welcome, Blair, by the way.
Thank you. I'm sorry I'm late. It's raining hard on the mountain.
Oh, okay.
I'll make a motion on this. Move that we accept the turkey depredation rule, the new rule R657-69 as presented by the division.
Okay, we have a motion by Carl to accept the new turkey depredation rule R657-69 as presented. Do we have a second?
Second.
Second by Chris Mikos. Any questions on the motion? All in favor? Any opposed? It's unanimous.
Thank you.
Item number 6, proposed fee schedule fiscal year 2015, Kenny Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, RAC members. I am Kenny Johnson, the Admin Services Chief out of Salt Lake. And we've got a few fees to discuss tonight, some new opportunity, and then just some changes to the fee schedule. And just by way of kind of reminder, I know this is probably old hat for most of us, the fee change process itself, they first come through our public process, which is why we're here tonight at the RAC. Then the Wildlife Board considers that proposal and approves them or modifies them. They then go to the governor's office for review, and then the governor's office makes recommendations to the legislature. Then we work with our Natural Resources Appropriations Subcommittee to approve, modify, or reject the fee proposals. And then any committee-approved fees are included in the big bill. And an annual appropriation bill for the whole state, and they're voted on by all the legislators. And then those fees take effect after the session, and in this case it would be July 1st of 2015. So just a real quick funding overview. Again, this is probably not new to most of us in this room. Most of our money comes from that green slice. The sale of hunting and fishing licenses, that's our restricted revenue, and that's how the division operates and continues to fulfill its mission. We get a little tiny bit of general fund from the legislature, that red slice, about 9%, a little bit less than that maybe on most years. And then we've got some dedicated credits, and those are typically co-ops projects we have with other agencies and other partners for conservation, and then some federal funds as well. So really being primarily funded by the participation of anglers and hunters and trappers, it's a fine balance. We try to balance the fees with increasing costs to manage the programs. And so for 2015, we've got a few opportunities that are new that we'll talk about, and then a couple of minor changes as we work through these. So bobcat, you'll see a proposed fee change. Muskrat, you'll see a proposed fee change, and then a change future in a different rule that'll come back out through the racks on how we want to handle the way we issue muskrat permits now for primarily our waterfowl management areas. And then a two-cal elk permit, which is kind of a new concept. One person can buy a two-cal permit was the idea there. And then Rocky Mountain and Desert Bighorn ewe opportunities, which are also new. And again, the fees, there's a lot of stuff that goes into the implementation of these fees. Tonight really just establishes a placeholder, establishes the fee, and lets us move it into the fee schedule that exists. And most of the detail will come out in future acts about how it will be implemented and how it will work, and you know whether there's bonus points with Desert Bighorn U and all that good stuff. So tonight just kind of sets the fee and puts it in the schedule so that down the road managers can use that new fee for something beneficial in the program. The fees tonight, we don't expect it'll significantly increase revenue. When we did an analysis of the programs and what was impacted, about $60,000 new dollars maybe coming into the state to help with some of the programs. And again, the new revenue will just kind of be used to help fund and manage the associated programs. So Bobcat revenue in particular, our costs with this program continue to increase. One of the things that I probably should have included in the presentation for last night are just some of the ancillary costs to managing Bobcats. There's a lot of costs that go into it administratively for tagging and checking those in and doing the tooth aging, doing the harvest report every year, the harvest statistics. There's just a lot of costs involved with it. And specifically some of those are listed there in that second bullet. Some of the rabbit transects, those costs continue to climb. So we think the proposal will kind of help manage this process and this program into the future. And it's probably worth noting that pelt prices right now, last year, the most recent survey information that we had, the average was $407 in pelts. So what we're proposing, currently the resident, non-resident fee for Bobcats is the same. It's $5. We're proposing an increase of up to $15. So from 5 to 15, those quantity estimates are actually based on last year's actual sales numbers. And so we estimate new revenue about $44,000 from residents and about $8,000 in new revenue from non-residents for Bobcats. Muskrat, again, this is this really isn't a recreational trapping opportunity. It's intended to meet a real critical need on our waterfowl management areas. And so one of the hopes is we can get the right people contracted to protect our dikes and levees from the muskrats that are causing some problems. And so the current way this works is just kind of a random draw, and then they pay a kind of a sliding scale fee based on how many muskrats they think they'll remove, and it really doesn't meet what we want it to meet as far as protecting those dikes and levees and saving public money there. So we're proposing tonight to just drop that sliding scale that's in the fee schedule now. It's currently between $30 and $155. We just want to drop that from the fee schedule altogether. And then what we're going to propose is that this just become a contract process where we let people competitively bid for doing that work for us. Right now it generates, I think last year that was the exact figure, the actual was $560. And so, you know, we think this will increase revenue slightly, but more importantly, we think it'll get the right people out at our waterfowl management areas taking care of those excess muskrats. So there's just our projections on muskrats. So currently it's that 30 to 155. There's about 12 permits granted a year, and we just want to put that out for open bid. And we think that'll increase revenue to that $2,400 or so. The 2-cow permit revenue. Right now there isn't a fee for this, so this is a new fee and a new opportunity. We're proposing for residents an $80 tag price for that. We estimate about 40 of those annually, and that's kind of taken into account that could offset some other permits that are out there. And so that was the best way to estimate the revenue. And then for non-residents, $350, and we anticipate about 10% of what our residents get will go to non-residents. So again, just that $4,600 new potential revenue. And then ewe hunting, again, this is a new opportunity for eventual use in the management plans. Right now, removing problem animals ourselves is kind of the first line of defense if we have animals moving around. And really, we want that to be an opportunity we can share with hunters and allow it as a population management tool if we need it. And there's no fee to do that now. They actually sign up for it on the depredation webpage. But there's no associated fee to make that work, and so we're just trying to establish the fees for these and allow the public kind of a new unique opportunity and a way to help and give them a chance to hunt. So what we're proposing there for residents, currently no fee. There's a proposal of $100 for that permit. We estimate maybe 10 of those on years where we might need to do some of that work. So the revenue is really not too significant. Non-residents, we would charge $300 if that opportunity were made available to non-residents. So just in summary, couple new fees, couple minor fee adjustments, and we really just hope they do a few things. Bring us some new tools to manage populations, manage wildlife, but also create some new opportunity for the public to participate and to get out and hunt. And then, like we talked about, just bring in more needed revenue to manage those programs and manage those species and make sure that we're getting the work done that we need to do. And that is all I have. Thank you.
Thanks, Kenny. Are there any questions from the RAC?
Yeah, the 2-cow permit, was that passed somewhere? Or just I didn't catch that in any previous meeting.
No. In fact, that's kind of what we're doing tonight is establishing a fee for it, and then at some point in the future, we'll bring out another rule through the RACs that says here's how we plan to implement 2-cows if we go to that as an option. So it's not in any work plan yet. It's just an idea for a new opportunity and a new option to use in areas where there's probably lower access and higher elk densities.
So what's a current cow, 45?
Mm-hmm.
So why not just double it?
It's a valid question.
Seems like a
volume discount.
Yeah, I think the idea is to discount it a little bit to provide some incentive for, you know, if we need somebody to go in and take 2 cows, it's a lot of work. Maybe not the most glamorous hunt, but still just provide a little bit of a
different
approach.
So basically what you're
doing
is just trying to get ready for something that's going to come up later.
Yeah, with that one.
I have a question. Do we have problem bighorn sheep right now, more specifically desert bighorn sheep?
I think that's a valid question, too, and maybe I'll have Bill help me with that one. I don't know that we've got any problem ones right now.
I would be shocked and amazed if that is the case,
especially
desert.
And non-biologists, occasionally we have some issues where they're moving around and we don't want them to.
Yeah, this isn't like a depredation problem or something like this. This is a problem where bighorn are moving in areas where there are domestic sheep, and we don't want them to come in contact with them. And if they're in those areas, we call it a no-tolerance zone. You know, it's kind of a bad word to use right now because of some things happened with cougars up in Sandy. But basically, we don't want to have bighorn sheep where there are domestic sheep. So this last year, we had to remove 11 on the South Book Cliffs just over past the Nash Wash area. I believe it was maybe 2 rams and the rest of ewes. And so there is that. A couple of those. With desert bighorn, we had the Sun Glow sheep herd over by, out of Torrey over there. And those sheep hung around for a couple of years before we finally were able to remove them. But we just don't want to risk those animals coming in contact with domestic sheep and then going back and mixing with the wild sheep.
So you'd rather give hunters opportunity to take them around?
Well, especially like in the SunGlow situation where they were living there, you know, that gives somebody an opportunity to do it. It also, though, gives us a chance, this permit gives us a chance in the future to manage bighorn in the if we ever get to the point that we don't have places to move them. For example, the Zion unit, which is a desert bighorn unit, and also the 9 Mile unit with Rocky Mountain bighorn, those populations have grown to the point we need to move animals. Fortunately, right now we have transplant sites, but if we ever get to the point we don't, we would rather go in and remove some ewes for population management that rather than let the populations
that'll
crash.
That'll be a great day, Bill.
That would be
get
fantastic.
To the point where we,
yeah, if we ever have that problem.
If our populations are that big, yeah. That'll be a great day.
Nevada, but that's Nevada opened a ewe hunt this year.
He did, yeah. Yeah, so that's the idea. It's just to, and Daryl, with the 2-cow permit, that's just something to have in case we need it in the future. And the idea that we're really looking at is like the Wasatch West unit. We have some large ranches that are not in the CWMU program. You have lots of million-dollar homes up there. They don't allow hunting access. They've got about 14,000 acres right next to the Coyote Little Pole. CWMU, and those the hunters can't get in and access those. And then they go down in the winter down by Heber City and do a lot of damage. So we're just trying to develop a tool we can use in situations like that. So it's just in the planning stages, and you guys will have your input on them.
So why not allow, instead of having one hunter get 2 permits, mm-hmm. have 2, you know, more hunters? What's the reason?
Blair, would you like to address that?
I'd love to jump in on this, but I'm not going to.
Oh. The problem is the amount of hunting pressure. The more people you put in there, the more stirred up the elk we get. And so we're thinking if one person had 2 permits, they go in there, they have a chance to shoot 2, they do it, and, you know, just increases the opportunity. I think fewer people, higher success rates. Chances are, though, somebody's going to shoot 1 and they'll be done in most cases, I think. But.
Bill, my comment would be on that is mm-hmm. that we already allow 2 cow elk tags per hunter per year.
We do.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Already. And so why do this? Why not have your hunter go in and get 2 individual tags and hunt 2 separate units or 2 separate areas versus mm-hmm. a tag that just gives you or a permit that allows you for 2 tags? So are you restricting yourself to 1 unit by doing this or 1
right.
hunt area?
Yes, it would
and
be.
Then you can kill your 2 cows in 1 area and not go someplace else.
Right. Mm-hmm. So like if the person is in that area, let's say they're able to get access on private land, then they can take 2 elk there from that unit. Yeah, they'll be unit specific, not, you know, general 2 cow permit statewide kind of
right.
thing.
And my I guess what I would say is what you've got is let's just say they put in for Range Creek.
Uh-huh.
And they get 2 cow tags for Range Creek. Does that mean on our 500 cow tags, all of a sudden we've got 1,000 cow tags coming? If this were to be implemented, what's going to happen here?
I think that initially I don't envision it being used that much on public land units, more on private land units,
okay.
like up on the Ogden and the and Rich and you know, like even the Wasatch West with those problems up there. But, yeah, I don't foresee it really taking off down here, but that's will be up to you guys to determine in the future if we get if the elk population grows much more. So, sorry, Kenny.
No, thank you.
Thanks,
I have
Bill.
About the bobcat proposal. So this $15 fee—that's a self-reported thing, and yet they pay $15 per bobcat that they trap.
Yeah, per permit.
Permit.
So it happens before. Yeah.
So they pay $15 for a permit, but there's no limit on the number of bobcats they can catch on that permit.
There are yes. They're actually this year was it 3, Bill? So the limit was 3 per person this year, and you had to pay the $5 for all 3. Each of the 3 permits before you could go trap.
I was just wondering if you ever thought of tying this fee into the pelt price. Seems like that's a pretty good bargain for a $407 pelt.
It is probably a bargain. It would be kind of hard, probably on the kind of preparing our sales day. They go on sale typically October 1st. They sell first come, first serve until they're gone. Mm-hmm. And establishing kind of a moving target for the fee might be hard. But really, we just want to make sure that, you know, it's a zero-sum game at the end of the day, and we just want to make sure we're covering our costs. And we think this gets us a lot closer. It still probably doesn't cover the cost of the entire program statewide, but it gets us closer than where we've been in recent years with the $5.
Any other questions from the RAC? Okay, we'll have questions from the audience, and we'll get your comment. Come up to this microphone here in the middle. Make some room for him. We'll get to comments here in just a minute. This section's questions.
I want to make sure that I understood that.
Okay. Will you state your name, too, for the record, please?
Harvey Howard.
Thanks.
I wanted to make sure that I understood that correctly. Are you estimating that you will sell 4,400 Bobcat tags this year? Was that the number I seen?
That's the number you saw, and that was based on actual sales from last year. We know that number is going to go up a little bit this year, depending on what gets passed through the RAC. So okay, that revenue may...
That was my question, is because last year you sold approximately 4,200. Is that what it was? Is that where the cutoff was?
46.
46.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
Yeah. Yeah, good memory. That's
okay,
true.
So to me, that number's extremely misleading from what you're looking towards. Last year, you could only get 3 Bobcat tags. About half of the people that I know of that normally trap didn't get Bobcat tags. Now you're going to make that, or your proposal is to make it unlimited in the amount of people that can get Bobcat tags and raise that to 6 Bobcat tags per person. So to me, them numbers that you put up there were pretty misleading.
And we're not trying to mislead. What we did is based the revenue projection. So months ago when we started looking at fees, we just based the revenue projection on actuals. And now we know in the presentation you're going to hear next that there's going to be a proposal for more Bobcat tags. The revenue will increase some. I haven't spent a lot of time looking at the numbers, but I think Bill's looked at them a little bit.
Yeah.
And
when we had that unlimited tags before, the most we ever sold was 11,000. So this year I'm anticipating it's going to be much closer to 11,000 than it is 4,600.
Right.
Just have to see where it ends up.
Okay. Well, I looked at them numbers and that didn't...
Yeah. And we've talked about it.
Yeah.
So that number I was looking for was the 11,000, because that was the last time you was under a similar system you're proposing. Okay,
right.
Thank you.
Thanks for clarifying.
Any other questions from the audience?
David Brown. I was wondering on the 2U tags, is that going to be unit specific or is that going to be statewide?
It would.
The two cow tags or the U tags? You said 2U.
The bighorn tags, right? The U permits. It would likely be unit specific. Again, we don't really know, but we just want to be able to use that as an opportunity for more hunting.
It actually may be more than type than just unit specific. If we have problem animals, we're going to tell you can go hunt between these roads. Here's where they are. This won't be a once in a lifetime. We're going to bring a proposal to the RAC, to the board, probably waiting for 5 years or so.
So you're going to have to use where you're having problems,
right.
Not just. And then on the.
We want to make sure that everybody comes to the microphone when they're talking. Bill, that includes you.
On the Bobcat, am I to understand that the proposal now is not to have a quota?
Yeah, I think you'll see that one here in a few minutes, but I don't remember where it ended up. Is it unlimited?
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from the audience? We'll move into the comment. First up is Jerry Swayze. James Butterfield, you're on deck.
I guess I got caught up in the computer glitch last year and was marginal whether we was going to get our tags or not. So hopefully that's all straightened out and going. And the $15 increase, I guess a $10 increase, I think that's a little expensive if you're going to go with six tags in there. Because there's no guarantee that you're going to catch cats or not catch cats. So if you went to $10, it'd be better than the $15, I think, or just leave it where it's at for that. I did pay $15 for my tags, but when you see the math and the numbers are there, if you don't get your tags at that time, then I knew that DWR probably reimbursed because the proclamation had specified $5. So go ahead and jump on that. But so that's, I guess, my biggest concern there.
Okay. Thanks, Jerry. James Butterfield with Brandon Payne next.
Mine is on the fee for the tag and the comment about the $400 average for the Bobcats. I was expecting $400 this last year because everybody said it was. I got $150. If you live in Moab, you got to get away from people. You're spending $1,500 just in gas. You got to drive an hour, then get on your four-wheeler and drive another hour just to get away from people. And if you do what you're supposed to be doing, checking every 48 hours, you're barely making gas money if you're trapping. You do it for teaching. I'd mostly like to do it time with my kids. And I don't want to pay more money for it. I don't really make money anyway. So I don't think that there are people that do catch all six cats. But if you know about trapping, and I'm pretty sure I know all the guys that are really good at it, they get all their cats, but they work their butts off daylight till dark to do it. And to do it right, it will be upside down if we go have to pay more for our tags. And I haven't made $400 for a cat for a while. So that's just what I wanted to share.
Thanks, James. Brandon Payne next with Kent Fowden on deck.
My name's Brandon Payne. I'm representing myself as a trapper. I'm opposed to the fee increase for Bobcat tags, specifically because your number 4,400 estimate, if I gather you right, that's the number of Bobcats you sealed last year. Is that correct?
Is the number of tags from last year?
No, the number of tags that you guys sold was 4,700 and some tags. So you sold close to 4,800 tags last year.
Closer to 47.
Okay, so say 4,700 tags last year is what you sold.
It was broken out resident and non. So there was a couple hundred below that.
But the cap was 4,600. Yeah. And you sold out last year. You sold out the year before that. Okay, I just wanted to clarify how you came up with the 4,400, number one.
That's the resident number that was sold last year.
That you sold last year, yep. Okay. I would like to propose you hold off on increasing the Bobcat fee this year. In a few minutes, we're going to discuss allowing six tags per person, no cap on the total number of tags sold. Let's see how that plays out. If you end up selling 11,000 tags, you're going to far exceed your projected revenue that you're hoping to get with the, you know, $10 fee increase. As far as an increase on non-residents, I don't know that I'm opposed to that, but I'm not a non-resident. So, as far as, yeah, it looks like we're making lots of money. We can trap, you know, last year, three bobcats, get $400 a piece. Gas was pushing $4 a gallon, you know, like was brought up, 48-hour trap check. We've got to check those traps every 2 days. This information is taken from the statewide bobcat trapping harvest statistics from 1982 to 2013. The average over those 31 years is 1.7 bobcats per trapper. The highest it ever got was in 2006, 2007, and that was three bobcats per trapper. So just because we get six tags doesn't mean we're going to make, you know, ungodly amounts of money, because we're going to catch six bobcats and get $500 or $600 a piece for them. That would be great, but according to the DWR's information, according to my personal experience, it's not working that way. You know, we're not doing it for the money. We're doing it for the chance to get outdoors, to, you know, get our kids exposed to it, recreation, and hopefully we can offset some of our expense in the meantime. So again, like I said, I'm opposed to the fee increase at this time, because I would like to see how removing the cap on the tags plays out. I think you will get more than your revenue increase because of that. Thank you.
Thanks, Brandon. Kent Bowden next with Sanford Randall on deck.
Vice Chair, members of the RAC, appreciate your time and the opportunity to speak with you. I'm Kent Fowden. I represent the Utah Trappers Association. I would ask that you support us in holding off or denying this action at this time for various reasons, most of which I feel is it's a knee-jerk reaction to the fiasco that took place in October. I think the $15 was a random mistake, and they're trying to. There's an appearance of capitalization on that mistake. There's no math yet. Last night, Mr. Bates told us that he was going to do some investigation. There's no hard numbers. We understand that costs increase and things like that, but there's no hard math to substantiate a tripling, a random tripling in one fell swoop of the fee. Some sort of math should follow or preclude that. Just back it up, in our opinion. The non-resident, again, we're not non-residents. We can't speak for them. I would support leaving that alone. The muskrat, the managers of the wildlife refuges have needed that tool for quite some time, and I'm pleased to see that on there. Their hands has been tied over the years, so thank you.
Thanks, Kent. Sanford?
Sanford Randall. I also would oppose the increase of the tax. The thing I noticed is on the screen up there, the bottom bullet point was that pelts were $407 average. And when you look at that, you think, okay, I'm paying $5 for a tag, I'm getting $407 for a pelt. Well, that's assuming that the pelts are going to stay at that price. There's been many years that I was hoping and that I could average $100. And I dare say that in 5 years from now, when that price goes back down, we're not going to be here saying, oh, we need to give the trappers a refund, or we need to lower the tags, we need to lower the prices because the pelt prices are low. That's not going to happen. The other issue that I have is any time that you see any public entity that is the gas company, any things like that, that they're making a price increase, they're usually making a price increase of 10%, something like that, and there's usually quite a public outroar. And this one, we're looking at a 200% increase on this fee. And a 200% increase, if you did that in any other business, It would have outrage from the public like nothing else. And so it's ridiculous to me to see that we can have a 200% increase just because, first of all, like Ken said, that there's no hard math behind it. There's no math behind it. The idea that there's that the pelt prices are high is one of the reasons to do it is ludicrous to me, because that is not a constant. That's not something that's going to stay there. It's good right now, but it won't stay there forever. And so I would suggest that we don't increase those tags. Thank you.
Thank you, Sanford.
If it would help, I've done a little bit. Kenny and I have talked a little bit, and we've got a few numbers if that would help clarify things.
I think that would.
Okay. The reason for raising the permit is it was originally established at $5 in 1980. We've never increased the cost of or price on a bobcat permit. If you look at the cost of the program, Kenny looked at the cost codes we use in that program, and we're spending about $100,000 a year on it.
The average just in Fur Bear the last 2 years is about
$116,000.
That's without any admin time. That's without front counter time. I'm not even sure it includes the harvest survey time.
So okay. And even if we do, you know, sell 11,000, 15,000 permits, whatever it is next year, there's still a fixed cost per bobcat that is harvested. If we anticipate the harvest will probably go up, you know, around 3,300 next year or something like that. That's the last time we had unlimited permits. We harvested about 3,300 bobcats, and we for those bobcats, a segment of those, we take a tooth and have that aged, and it's about $4 per bobcat. So the costs will go up as the harvest goes up. So last night, one of the things I committed to was maybe coming back and finding out what an actual cost was for the program. And, you know, what's really happened from 1980 until now is other revenues, you know, other fishing, or not fishing, but other hunting permits have subsidized the Fur Bear program. And so we're just trying to balance that out. So hopefully that helps.
Thanks, Bill. I don't have any other comment cards from the...
Yeah.
Sure.
Just one thought that come to mind is if instead
will you state your name again? Sorry,
Kent Fowden, Utah Trappers. Excuse me. Maybe we could take a look at putting that instead of an upfront fee on the tag. Apply if you in fact do raise it. Put it toward the CITES tags at the time of the tagging. It's just a thought. Then there's not a big investment for these guys up front. It is, again, it is not a money-making thing. It's most of these guys do this to spend time with their families and pass on a heritage and a tradition. It's not a get-rich scheme by any means. They're probably $600-$700 per pelt in costs, honestly, to harvest that cat. It's just not what people think. Thank you.
Thanks.
That was actually going to be my, Harvey Howard again. That was going to be my recommendation, to leave the permit fee at $5 to allow the trappers to trap, and then put your fee on your tagging operation at the time it's tagged permanently, so that it covers them after trapping costs. At that point, you know that the trapper has made, you know, a couple of dollars. Generally, I've never seen any of them make any money after they add their gas and stuff up, but that would be my recommendation, and I just wanted to state that.
Thanks, Harvey. I don't have any other cards, so let's go to comments from the rec.
I have a couple comments. Personally, I think cow elk, I actually think $45 is pretty cheap to fill my freezer, so I'm not opposed to just doubling that fee, but that's just a general comment. I grew up in a trapping family. My dad trapped during the winters to provide for us, and it was a bleak existence, I'll tell you that. So I understand what these guys are talking about. I'm also a little shocked by the huge increase. I would agree with you guys that an incremental increase is appropriate. I really like the idea of having a $5 fee up front and then maybe a $5 tag fee after that. And just, Wayne, just so you know, like with pelts, it's a really fluid market, and it also has a lot to do with how you care for your pelt. So it isn't a static number. It's an extremely fluid number. So well, it's really hard to pin something to that.
That was sort of why I was suggesting that you do it based on the, on pelts, because if you're not getting very much money for a pelt, why pay so much money for your permit? Okay. Yeah. But on the other hand, from my perspective as a non-consumptive user, I don't see any benefit in trapping bobcats. And, you know, so I don't really care if there's permits for bobcats. So I have no problem with whatever the DWR thinks they need to recoup their costs.
Something I think we haven't talked about, and I'm not an economist, but it seems to me that if we open this up to unlimited, we're going to increase our harvest, which decreases the price of the pelt, right? Supply and demand. Am I crazy there? Or is that economics? I remember. Sure.
I think there's some truth to that, but pelt prices are set on a national basis. You know, it's just whatever the going rate is. The market sets them, and it could be anywhere. And so it's there's a lot more to it than just that. It's, you know, what is the demand for them, and that's what drives the price.
Any other comments from the rack? I would entertain a motion.
I don't know how to modify what is existing, so maybe you guys can help me. But specifically on the bobcats, I would motion that. I'm not sure quite how to state that. That we keep the fees as such, and maybe there is an additional tag fee upon. Do they have to turn in the jaw? I'm not sure what the process is that right? An additional $5 fee upon that time to pay for the aging. That's my motion.
And
does that make any sense?
Oh, yeah. Now, what about the rest?
I would motion that the two cows is $90. I'm not sure why it wouldn't be. That's my other motion.
Okay, so the two cow permit as instead of $80, $90. The bighorns, you're okay with that one?
Sure.
In the spirit of transparency, I believe that a cow permit is $50, not $45. Is that correct?
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
So it's $50.
Well,
so
I wouldn't know. I didn't draw a cow tag.
I didn't either, so I'm just guessing.
Okay, so do you want to double that and make it an even C note?
Make it an even 100? That seems like a great idea.
Just, okay, maybe we say it double the existing cow fee. How's that sound?
That sounds great, Carl.
It is 50.
It is 50. Okay. Okay, so you want to double the cows of the existing.
Yes.
The bighorn ewe tag was fine. Muskrat's fine. We want to propose that the bobcat stays at 5 for the permit, and then an additional 5 when you, what do you call it, check it in or send it in.
Okay.
What if we leave that at 10?
You want to leave? You just want to leave?
I know it.
Yeah, so if you buy a
tag,
you'll
do
it. Yeah. And then if you trap and
okay.
You know, bobcat, you pay $10.
I'm fine with that, Blair.
Okay.
So you should state that.
I would live with that.
So Blair proposes that we leave the fee at $5.
Okay.
And upon sealing, is that what you call that, Chris?
Right.
we'll leave that at 10, and then that way you're getting your 15. How do you feel about that?
No, this is our opinion.
I'm just talking about
Okay. Where are you at here, Brent? You want me to try to state that?
Yes.
Yes,
please.
Go okay. for it, Todd.
Trish made a motion to for the Bobcat fee to be split into two parts, $5 for the permit, $10 upon sealing the pelt, the two cow permit to be double the current price, and all other fees as presented. How'd I do?
I second that.
Second by Blair. Any comments on the motion? All in favor?
Hang on.
Man, you're moving.
Wayne,
well,
gotta go quicker.
It just seems to me that by making that fee for the Bobcat so complicated, you're actually adding to the cost of doing that. And if this is not going to be,
you've got to check those in anyway.
Yeah,
correct.
There is. Wayne is right, though. From one aspect, TJ brought it to my attention that it would really complicate things because right now our conservation officers or biologists are able to check those bobcats in the field, and if they had to collect money, they'd have to be bonded, and it would be it'd be a nightmare. So it would increase the costs of the program.
Now what?
Cut the difference. Right. How about we cut the difference and we make it 750? Does it have to be a solid number?
I don't think so.
That being the case, I got a couple comments. One, if you look at the overall program and the funding, it appears to me that elk and deer, some of the big game, carries a lot of these small programs. And that does bother me. I think every program ought to cover its expenses. And really, I mean, I've done a bunch of numbers based on 4,700, 46, 44, 11,000, 15. You're paying a wage and an administrative cost, period. And I don't see a problem other than I see a lot of people out there who don't want to see this fee increase. You're not covering your costs. And I'm paying $980 a tag right now for my elk tags for the ranch, and I'm paying, I can't remember what the cow tag cost is, it's a whole lot more than 100 for my CWMU. So I'm really struggling that you get to kill six bobcats and pay $90. But I'll support you on this, but I think you need to give a little bit to help cover those administrative costs. And my recommendation would be that you know, we give a little and you give a little and we come someplace in the $10 figure. I still don't think that covers your costs, though. And I think you need to think about that as you're going forward. There's my 10 cents.
Do I hear eight?
I have a comment. Anytime you buy a permit or a tag to hunt or fish, there is no guarantee you're going to be successful.
Right.
And to me, you do it for the love of it, not to be successful every single time. So if I buy a deer tag and I go out and I shoot a deer, what I gain from that is the experience and a little bit of meat. But the excuse that it's costing me gas and traveling back and forth, that's part of the experience, and we all know it going into the sport. So I don't think that should be part of our weighing and measuring on this. I think it should be that you're doing it for other reasons than to break even or to make money.
Not okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate. Would you still buy a deer tag if it were tripled?
Yes.
Yes, I would, if it's something that I really wanted to do. It's a once-in-a-lifetime tag.
Okay,
costs you $500.
They can hear you, right?
Go ahead.
I think 100% increase is a large increase. So to put it at $10, I think is a more than that's asking a lot. Meaning, but it has been a long time since that fee has been set. So I think maybe to say $10, we should put that on the table. What do you think, Blair?
I believe that is correct. I believe we have a motion and a second. We probably need to vote on that. Okay.
We can either way. Let's get it off the table.
Let's go ahead and vote on this one because I think I see where it's going to go. So, okay. So, I'm not going to restate it again. It's too complicated. Okay, so all in favor? All opposed?
The person who made the motion has to vote for it.
I didn't want to make TJ's life harder.
Okay, motion fails.
Mr. Chairman, can I maybe make a suggestion or bring up some more information?
Sure.
Okay, one other thing that hasn't been brought up tonight is they also have to buy a fur bearer license for $29 in addition to the bobcat permits. But what I was going to suggest you consider maybe, and not to put words in your mouth or anything, but last night at the Southern Region RAC, they recommended that the division go back and look at how much would we need to raise a permit to cover our costs and then go to the Wildlife Board with that figure rather than the $15.
So, Bill,
something like that.
$110,000.
Real
simple math. $116,000
would
cost
$10
permit.
$29
per bear is covered
your expenses. Bill, so basically the Southern Region recommended that you just take whatever that figure is to the Wildlife Board and go with that.
Right.
Without them really knowing anything.
Well, not quite.
Okay.
What they recommended is that we that the permit be approved to cover our costs, and they made the motion not to exceed $15. Isn't that right, Ken? But that might not have passed. It might have ended up just to cover our costs.
Bill, do other programs like this, like the Bobcat program, do they cover their costs? Most of them. Apparently the muskrats don't.
No, muskrats are nowhere near covering theirs.
But in general, do most programs cover their own costs?
You know, that's a really good question. Right now, fishing is being subsidized by deer and elk hunting. But in the past, it's been the opposite. So, we don't have a cost accounting. It's saying that every program has to absolutely cover itself. What we need to do is cover our
own. Sure.
Right.
I understand that.
But we try to make it covered. That's why the license fee increase we had last year was mostly designed to increase revenue from fishing. So.
Wayne.
I would make a motion.
Okay.
That we accept the proposed fee schedules for the bobcat, muskrat, two cow elk permit and the bighorn ewe permits. I guess I would go with $100 or $90 for the two cow, but I thought that when it was explained to us that kind of made sense that this was a way of getting this second cow harvested when it was needed to be harvested. And it was primarily going to be on private property and things like that. So it was, it's a way of sort of enticing somebody to actually spend that extra $30 to get two instead of one. So I don't have a problem with that. But what I would suggest is that with the bobcat that we actually go with something like that we would propose very much the same idea of limiting the increase to $15, but to have it really based upon some figures about the cost of the program, and if that's undetermined, that we would go with $10 as a recommendation. In other words, the DWR would try to come up with an estimate of the cost, of administering a permit, and if they couldn't come up with a cost that they could, you know, justify, then we would go with a $10 fee instead of a $15 fee. But $15 would be our maximum, even if it costs more than that to administer the permit. Is that?
I'm just not sure whether you want 80 or 100 for it.
I would go with $80 for the cow, two cow. I don't.
I'll second Wayne's motion so we can have a conversation.
You got it, Brent.
Can you just, that's my question too, Wayne. Can you explain that one more time?
Okay,
for us?
So for a bobcat permit, oops, where did I? We would suggest that the DWR determine the cost of administering the permit, and that the maximum they can charge for a permit would be $15. And if that figure comes out less than we, you know, then I would suggest that we go with a $10 permit for the time being. I don't know. I would really prefer that the DWR sort of come out with a way of covering their costs on this one. And I don't have a problem with problem with charging $15. But if it's not necessary, then.
Okay,
so I think we all understand what he's saying.
Let's just
correct
drop a $10 piece and just say, you know, the cost of the program or $15, whichever is less.
Yes. Okay, I'm going to try and state it here, Brent. Wayne's motion is that we accept the two cow elk, the bighorn ewe, and the muskrat as presented. That the bobcat fee is based on costs of the program or $15 max, whichever is less. Does that sound about right?
Yes.
Okay. So Wayne made the motion. Sue seconded. Any discussion on that? All in favor? Opposed? Tricia opposed. Motion passes. Item number 7, Cougar Management Plan Revisions and 2015 Recommendation. Leslie McFarland, Mammals Coordinator.
Who did you say?
And or Bill Bates.
Oh. What does it say on the agenda? Does it say Leslie? Okay. Yeah. I apologize before I even start. Last night was the first time I've done a RAC presentation for a while, and I was really rusty. I found out, you know, when you're a coordinator, you have to know everything, and I knew nothing. So it was kind of all over the place last night, and hopefully it won't be as bad tonight. But the good news on the permit fee increases we just talked about is that we're really early into the planning stages. We just came up with some ideas on what fees we thought we might want to implement, and you know, and we'll be able to go back and take the input, even Trisha's input on, you know, having the elk you know, be the same price. That's something we can still consider, but this is a real good place to start. So appreciate the input. It's been a good discussion. Leslie McFarland has recently been hired as our new mammals coordinator. She was our wildlife disease coordinator, but She couldn't be here this week because if you may have heard this last winter, we had the outbreak of West Nile virus with the eared grebes and we had 74 bald eagles that died from that disease. And she was asked to be a keynote speaker at a wildlife disease conference down in Albuquerque. So that's where she is. And so she's laughing at me, but enjoying herself down there. But I'm excited about Leslie taking over. I really think she'll do a great job, and I think she'll have a good time coming down here to these presentations. We'd like to start out with a little bit of explanation of where we are right now. Last year, if you remember, when we did the cougar recommendations, Carl wasn't here, and I don't know if you know how things are. We're in the cougar management plan, but we're managing on cougar management areas or eco regions. We had, I believe, 8 of them. We'll see here in a little bit how many there were statewide. And there was a quota that was set for the entire region. And if the quota on a harvest objective unit closed within a small hunting area, within that large area, it just closed there. But there was also a quota for the entire area. And as you can see, I'm having a really hard time explaining it right now. And so we were directed by the Wildlife Board to go back and simplify the plan and allocate permits on a unit-by-unit basis. And I apologize that we didn't carry through on that completely. But what I'm going to offer you tonight is kind of a Band-Aid approach to simplify the plan for 1 year. But next year, what we'd like to do is we reconstitute the Cougar Advisory Board or panel or committee, whatever, and redo the plan and come back with something that makes sense. I thought this was being taken care of, but it's something that fell through the cracks, and our former mammals coordinator recently took another job, and actually heard... I was listening to KUER today, and my ears were pricked up when I heard that they were going to do do an interview on the war on predators, and they were going to interview an expert on predators who will remain nameless. But that's kind of the things I think he was involved with this last year, and this didn't get done. And so I apologize that we don't have it there, but I think what we are going to recommend tonight will simplify the plan and actually do what the board asked in some respects. So we've had two different committee meetings, actually. In May 19th, our former coordinator met with part of the Cougar Advisory Board. Not everybody was invited to the meeting, and they came up with some suggestions and agreements, which after we looked on further review, we as a division couldn't go along with. And so we got together the Utah Houndsman Association, United Wildlife Cooperative, and SFW in kind of an emergency meeting to try to come up with some kind of compromise for this year. And what we recommended we'd do is we'd still keep the ecoregions or the large areas to compile and analyze data, because the problem is you don't harvest a lot of cougars like you do deer or elk as an example. And so you need to have enough data to have meaningful data and do interpretation. So we're still going to analyze data on the large areas, but we're going to analyze or issue the permits on a unit basis, just like we do with deer or elk. And the quotas will only be for that hunting area. We won't have any more overriding quotas for ecoregion. And we're also proposing to eliminate female subquotas, and we're going to, we've been on a 3-year rotation, we've recommended cougar permits just using the model in the cougar management plan, and they've been set for 3 years. Well, we're going to change that, and we're going to come back annually and bring those to you so they can be reviewed. And that way we don't have the need for the female subquota anymore, because that was put in place just to make sure we weren't over-harvesting an area. And something else the Utah Houndsman Association asked, in the plan right now, it says that we would use as one of our triggers the proportion of adult females in the harvest. And they felt that that was a mistake, and they wanted to include all females in the harvest analysis. And so we've actually done that for this year. And our permit recommendations are based on that as well. So the other thing I hope that you will make as part of your motion is that we do bring the Cougar Advisory Board back together to further simplify the plan and redo it, even though it's not due to end for quite some time. And the 40% females, total females, is something we will consider in that. So here's a map that shows that idea of the ecoregions or the cougar management areas are the large areas in black, but then the smaller shaded, the gray areas, those would be the units. So that's about the same thing as the, or probably is the exact same boundaries as we have for deer. And with this plan that we're recommending today, the quotas will be set on an individual unit. The performance targets we looked at, on a cougar, let me back up here for a second. We'll talk about this more, but just to refresh everybody's memory, we have some units that are in predator management plans, and we have some that are in what we call cougar management units. The cougar management units are units where the deer population is meeting its objective. If it's in a predator management unit, that means that it's at least 90, less than 90% of its population objective, or the adult survival in the representative unit has been less than 85% for two of the last 3 years, or less than 80% for the last year. And then the ones that are, I'm kind of colorblind, but the mauve color or whatever, the bighorn sheep areas, those are basically unlimited areas where we have year-round seasons with no quota, we just unlimited harvest. But that's like the Santa Fe Swell, down at the, Escalante, Caparitza, they're really rugged areas. Rattlesnake area, those are really hard places to hunt, and we don't over-harvest those areas.
Dale, just a question on that.
Okay.
That's the ones that are the predator units, is that what you're saying?
Okay, yeah, the predator management units are the ones that, Brad, help me out here, where'd you go? The bighorn sheep are predator management units, but they're kind of a step beyond.
Okay.
But like the Book Cliffs, San Juan, and I believe the Oaker Stansbury, those are, it actually depends on which unit it is within those ecoregions. But different units within those are not meeting their deer population objectives. So in those areas, the predator management units are either going to be managed as a harvest objective or a split unit, which means it's limited entry for the first part of the season and then quota for the remainder of the season. On a cougar management area, they're typically limited entry, or they could also be a split as well. But usually you have lower, number of permits or a lower quota on those cougar management areas versus the predator management areas. The idea in predator management areas, of course, is to reduce the cougar population to allow the prey to rebound a little bit. Okay, Wayne?
So does that mean that those various hunting units could move in and out of that cougar management?
Well, not necessarily, because the determination for that is how is the deer population doing.
Right.
Theoretically, if these predator management plans are making a difference, then yes, we're going to move out of the need for predator management, because the deer population is going to rebound, although we still have weather problems and other things that happen, so it's always a moving target. But the idea that we're working for is to try to move as many of them out of predator management as we can. So,
how long do you leave one in predator management?
That is
seeing the deer rebound.
That is a good question.
I'm just asking. Maybe it's not the lion's fault.
That's.
So how long do you kill them before you say, maybe that's not working?
If Kathy Jo will put that in the minutes, I guarantee you that the Cougar Advisory Board will look at that question, because I don't have the answer. But I think it's a really good question that we need to look at seriously. So.
Hey, Bill. The predator management plan is a 3-year plan. So
okay.
In 2016.
Okay, there's the short answer. Thanks, Guy.
You're welcome.
We'll
pick that up, though.
Okay. The predator management plans are written on a three-year, for 3 years, and so they will be reviewed in 2016. That's a quote from Guy Wallace. Okay. So anyway, the performance targets that are in the current plan were to look at the proportion of adult females in the harvest. If it was above 0.2, then we would decrease permits. If it was below 0.17, we'd increase them. There was a secondary target, the number of cougars treed per day. If the average is between 0.25 and 0.35, we leave it the same or adjust as necessary. But we ran the analysis both ways this year with just the adult females and also looking at all females. On predator management units, the regions can choose either, like I said, a split or harvest objective strategy, and the quota is assigned to each unit. The unit closes when the permits or quota are filled or when the season ends. And three units I've already mentioned, the Bookcliffs, Rattlesnake, Kaparowitz, and Sand Rafael, are bighorn sheep units with unlimited harvest and no quota. Well, unlimited. Okay. I think I'd really like to take a minute to look at this graph right here. Here's our cougar harvest from the time we went to limited entry in 1990 until this last year. The first cougar plan was implemented in 1999 and ran until 2010. So you can kind of see how that one, how it performed under that plan. And then, you know, it looks like its harvest has come up just a little bit with the new plan. But really, if you look at compared to the late 1990s, cougar harvest is almost only half of what it was before. And I don't think that, and I'd be interested to see what the houndsmen think, but I don't feel that represents necessarily the trend of the population. I think what that represents is the effectiveness of our management strategies in controlling harvest, but I'd be interested in getting feedback on that. Another thing to look at is the number of females in the harvest has also been fairly stable since about 2008. And the percent of females in the sport harvest, if we look at making that 40% as the new target, you can see that for the last 6 years, we've been for the last 10 years, we've either been at or below that 40%. Like I said, we went through and looked at the cougar management areas, and I also looked at, tried to look at individual units as best I could, but all of these have been less than the 40% with their average for the last 3 years. And even if you look on a one-year basis, the only one that went over the Uintas was 42% in 2012. The Manti was 40% this last year. But we've still been managing fairly well within that 40% total females. So anyway, here's our recommendations with our limited entry units. That means where a person draws a permit, has all season to hunt if they want. There's no quota on that unit. They have from November 12th through May 31st. The split units, the limited entry, will run from November 12th through February 26th, be closed for a short time, open up again on March 5th, and then go through May 31st. Harvest objective, those units are basically year-round, and the pursuit season would go from November 12th to May 31st. Another recommendation we'd like to bring up today is to split the Pine Valley unit. And the reason to do this is we're starting to have some problems with cougars with bighorn sheep down around in the Zion unit. And so what we'd like to do is split that along Highway 18 and make the Pine Valley North a split unit and the south part harvest objective. Kind of give you an idea what that will look like. Our total number of limited entry and split permits has been decreasing. It was 347 in 2012 to 13, and this year we're only recommending 253. But that doesn't tell the whole story. What you'd have to also look at is what has the quota done, and because some of the units have gone away from being limited entry or split and become harvest objective only units. But I think in your packet you've seen this. If there's any questions, we could talk about specific units. But based on the number of females and the cougar treed per day, these are the number of the permits the regions are recommending. Probably one of one that we ought to talk about a little bit. We've increased the quota on the Dutton because we released the mountain goats there last year. The Book Cliffs, Bitter Creek, and the 9 Mile is an interesting one. Last year, when it was managed in the large ecoregion, we had a quota of 40 for the entire unit. We expected that about 50% of those lions would be harvested on 9 Mile, 50% on the Book Cliffs, but it turned out we had 35 of them taken over in the Book Cliffs and only 5 on 9 Mile, and then it closed. Of those 35 that were killed on the Book Cliffs, only 9 of them were females, so they took a lot of males, but the houndsmen are concerned that we've impacted that area, so in an agreement with them, the region modified their recommendation. They were recommending 25 permits and with a 25-15, but we've changed that to a 20-20 to try to have 50% on both of those. And so unless you have any questions on any of the specific units, that's our recommendation.
Questions from the rack? One question I had, Bill, was, if I can find it here, the permits will be increased by 2 on Mount Dutton to protect a recent goat transplant. Mm-hmm. Plateau Boulder, Plateau Thousand Lakes were each decreased by 1 so that the permits could be put on the Dutton. Mm-hmm. What's the connection there? Why do we need to remain neutral there?
Well, we still haven't gone through and modified the plan yet. And the plan, what the plan did is allocated a total number of permits per ecological area.
Okay.
And so in this keeping with the spirit of the plan, we try to balance them out. And, you know, if you want to make other recommendations.
I was just curious. I didn't know the answer to that, so thank you.
So that's the reason.
That clarifies. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. On the female subquota, you say you don't have that in this proposal?
We don't.
If you're not meeting that, what's the harm in having that?
We did meet it on. We did meet it on some areas, and it closed some units early that we could have had.
Let me rephrase that. Do you have any plans managing any of your other mammals out in the state that you don't take females into account? I mean, you don't have a deer hunt where you just kill them.
Well, I think
you'll adjust it by how many goes are killed. I don't understand the biology. Science. I don't understand.
Okay. You know, the female subquota is proactive up front to make sure you're protecting the female resource. We are confident with the permit recommendations that we're making that we are not going to impact the cougar populations. You know, we're not going to hunt any of these populations to a point that we're going to hurt them in any of these units with the recommendations we've made, especially since we're coming back a year later. And let's say we had the LaSalles and we killed 50% females. Well, the next year we could come back and.
How many females were killed on LaSalles?
What's that?
How many were killed on LaSalles?
Do you know, Guy? And it's also a predator management unit, so a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. I just don't see where you're. Obviously, you want to be able to kill more than 40% of females.
No, what we want to do is kill less than 40% on the average.
But you don't want a safety valve in there so that it stops.
We feel that we have plenty of safety valves with cougars.
You're giving me a political answer.
It's not political.
Say yes or no. You know, if you don't want that safety valve in there, then you don't put the 40% sub.
No, we don't feel we need the subquota as a safety valve. And the reason is there's so many sources and sinks out there. Like with the Book Cliffs, you've got the Hill Creek Extension, you've got Desolation Canyon, you've got Colorado, You know, there's other places that cougars can come from. You know, we know from research that they move many, many miles, and, you know, that the cougar population as a whole is really a metapopulation that moves around quite a bit. So, you know, based on, you know, my 30 years of working with cougars, I'm not worried that by eliminating the female subquota that we're going to hurt any of our cougar populations.
Well, there would be females migrating from other areas, too. I mean, you're
that's right.
Back in your population no matter what you do. Mm-hmm. So what you want is you do not want a safety valve.
We don't feel we need it. We feel that this, what we're proposing, will maintain safety for the viability of the population.
Explain that to me.
It's just like you just said. There are so many females moving in and out, or cougars moving around, that if there's an empty niche, we haven't seen evidence that that populations have been hurt by, you know, our hunting strategy. So, it's what kind of tool do you want to have? And last night, the Utah Houndsman Association made a proposal to make all units either to make them have a female subquota. You know, if a person draws a permit, you know, and uses their points on a limited entry unit, a female subquota doesn't make any sense at all to me, because a person has a chance to be selected. They've got the entire season to hunt, and so, you know, there's no need to have. And why would you know, if somebody draws a permit and burns their points for that, why would you tell them that they can't have the season to hunt? On the other, on this, you'll have a chance.
You'll have your chance, guy. Mm-hmm. You'll have your chance.
It's not a kill deal. It's a hunt.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You go out and hunt something. I imagine if they put their points and burn their points on a unit, mm-hmm. that's like me waiting to go kill my bighorn sheep. Well, the hell, it's the last day. I'll just shoot a little one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, really, you don't have to kill something every time
you don't.
Home, so I'm not buying into your argument there. What I want you to is to solidly tell me why you don't have a safeguard over an overharvest of females in the state of Utah. I don't care if the lions mm-hmm. from Cache County go to San Juan County.
Mm-hmm.
They still reside and travel in this area.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't you want to have a safety valve?
The data,
that's what concerns me.
Uh-huh. The data that we have from harvest data from 1990 to now demonstrates that a female subquota is not needed to provide that safety valve. The hunting strategies we employ have not harvested cougar populations. Well, because of the complications of, you know, areas.
We have hit them.
I don't have the data right here in front of me to tell you which units did close, but we had units that closed due to a female subquota. And we felt that there were some of those we would like to have got some more harvest on. So that's the reason why we don't want it. Doing the adjustments on an annual basis is the trade-off. That is the safety valve. Because if we over-harvest 1 year, we have the chance to compensate for it the second year. So we still do have a safety valve, and that is adjusting permits annually. If you would rather have a female subquota, then my recommendation would be we go back to 3 year, setting permits for 3 years, because that was the trade-off. In order to, we felt that we didn't need the female subquota, so in the meeting, Utah Houndsman Association agreed that if you will adjust your permits annually, we're okay with doing away with female subquotas. Yeah. So that's a trade-off.
The one piece of this, as long as I've been here, is, and I've talked to your previous biologists over this, Bunnell, Shubikin, mm-hmm. It seems that all your plans are driven from what the Wildlife Board wants. I would like to see a plan presented by your people that manages the cougar population and isn't driven by us or driven mm-hmm. by them.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe you guys got a handle uh-huh. on it and had a little more control than saying, well, the Wildlife Board said mm-hmm. this,
well,
so we're going to do this.
All the Wildlife Board told us was to do was to simplify the plan and to administer permits on a unit basis. That's the only direction we had. Personally, I was involved in writing the first cougar plan, and I think it worked for 10 years. I think that You know, the goal of the plan was to maintain viable cougar populations in balance with prey and other resources, and I think it worked. And I think it was a lot more simple than this plan is. And I feel that this plan really ties our hands as biologists, just like the thing that Todd brought up on the Dutton. You can't adjust two permits in an area where you've made a change in management because the plan dictates it. On this ecoregion, you have to have this many permits, and the number of permits are driven by the plan rather than by, you know, what the biologist thinks or from public input.
Well, I'll back up here, but I don't think you had the ability to put together a scientifically, biologically driven plan for years.
Well, I was part of the group that wrote that first plan, and I didn't feel any pressure from the Wildlife Board to write it a certain way.
Well, your previous coordinators felt huge pressure. They
were told
they need to make this work, they need to make it fit. I'll be honest with you, I had some pretty good visits with.
Well, maybe you and I can talk afterwards.
Okay.
Bill, how do you feel about the unit by unit instead of the ecoregion? Does that help you manage them better?
For me, absolutely. You know, the whole reason for going to unit by unit with deer was to direct pressure where we want. And I was actually speaking with Kaylin Lemon today, you know, and Byron Bateman, two different people I spoke with today that are houndsmen. And what happened last year is that some of the units in the Yuka regions got hunted heavier than others, just like with the Book Cliffs versus 9 Mile. And by being able to split the permits and the quota and put them where we want, it, you know, it gives us more flexibility as biologists to put the harvest where we want it. Now, I think that this is the other way. It can be more advantageous to the hunters and the guides because, you know, it allows a larger area to stay open and a quota to be shared. And so it's not as good at directing hunter pressure where we want it. So I feel that the unit by unit is a better way to do it.
Okay.
On the GPS proposal, the hounds have, is that a real hassle problem? I mean, you deal with your coyote thing. I think as far as coming from law enforcement background, and having outfitted for 20-some years before I give it up, you're going to have people tagging them in off the wrong units just to save a unit.
Mm-hmm.
Is that hard? I mean, it's simple. You've got Google Earth and
everything
has a GPS.
Daryl, that's
a,
that's a social question as far as, I mean, well, I want, you know, I would like to have the data, yes. You know, but I think that the question is, for a hunter, you have some hunters, when we implemented the coyote program, you had some that came in and said, well, I can't operate a GPS or I can't afford one. So I think that that's a question for you as the RAC. I'm comfortable with you guys answering that question. If you want to require it of them, I think it's great data for us to have. I've been told that some guys aren't ever going to tell us where they killed them, whether, you know, because they don't want us to know.
Oh, I'm sure that DJ has Google Earth on his laptop and thinks that this is the spot, and you can verify that.
Yeah.
It's not that hard. It's simple.
Well, as long as they're telling us truthful points, you know.
If they're not, then there should be a penalty.
Yeah. Well, I, you know, I'm not opposed to it, but, you know.
And now, why haven't my mouth shut up after
this? No, that's okay. It's best to answer.
Do we really want to get into this every year?
It was a trade-off. That's what the Houndsman Association asked for. And so I don't know. I guess you guys need to go back and answer that. I mean, we'd prefer it every 3 years. But I think that I don't think we have to answer that question tonight, Daryl. This is just a one-year thing. You know, we've got to get something fixed. It was too complicated for us to explain to the public. Now, the people that were involved in writing it, they understood it and it made sense to them, but if we can't even explain it, then it's too complicated.
Any other questions from the RAC? Questions from the audience?
I have one question, I guess.
Yeah, come to the mic, please, Guy.
Guy Webster, Utah Houndsman Association. I guess two questions. Was it not true the Utah Houndsman Association
met with John Shivik, the former coordinator, in May of this year and hashed out a plan. And then it came back because SFW wasn't happy with that plan and revisited.
That's not true at all. It went back because I wasn't happy with it, Guy.
Okay.
I'll take the heat for that.
Okay, second.
And I'll tell you what. John didn't even have never mind.
Okay. They did meet.
They met, but he didn't invite the entire committee. He purposely held it on a day when some people couldn't be there.
Okay. Secondly, you went to say in a limited entry where you draw a tag, why would you shoot or kill a female and it would close? Is a limited entry ever directed by a female sub
no.
to closing it? Because you draw the tag, it doesn't matter what you kill. Them data yeah. does not go in.
Last
in
night,
closing that.
Let me answer that. It's true. We've never had a female sub quota on a limited entry. But last night, Dan made a proposal at the meeting that I don't even know what it was. And it sounded like he was asking for a female sub quota on every unit.
Quota units.
Okay, well, he didn't make that clear last night.
Because a limited entry is not a quota.
Right.
So a female sub quota would only be on a quota unit, hand in hand.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions from the audience?
Yeah, David Bronson. I've got a concern. There are some areas, and the one I'm thinking of right now is the Escalante. And you've got a sheep population there that recently is being impacted by lions. And the problem is the access into that area, you know, limits to where lion hunters, they're not going to get in there. So it doesn't matter what you do, you're not going to have anybody hunting those lions. And what I'm wondering is the division got any kind of contingency or plans to deal with that?
Yeah, last year in that unit specifically, Dustin Shively went in with Wildlife Services and asked them to go and do some trapping and snaring. They took a helicopter, and I don't know that they ever found any sign active enough that they could do anything. I mean, you know what the area is like better than anybody, and it's just remote and, you know, dry and... Yeah. So it's a real problem, but you need something. We do need to keep working on that.
I've been in there for the last 8 years. When we started going in there, we didn't see any lion sign, and now there's lion sign everywhere.
It's a harvest subjective unit with no quota, so take your dogs with you.
Any other questions from the audience? Okay, we just have one comment card. Guy?
Guy Webster, board member, Utah Houndsman Association. I think all of you have got a copy of this if you don't. Basically, we're just asking you to reject the DWR's plan as presented. We do request that you do keep it on a unit-by-unit basis. I stood here last year specifically on the Book Cliffs and the Range Creek being put together, and I voiced that the bulk of the lions would come off the Book Cliffs, and I was told that that was a foolish thought, that that wouldn't happen. 35 out of the 40 came off of the Book Cliffs. Go on record that I forecast that, and unfortunately that forecast was 100% correct. We do request that there is a female sub quota, 40% on there. There needs to be a safety valve. There's some of these units that don't have a lot of lions left. The Henry Mountains, for example, three lions were killed off of it last year. That unit could be very easily over-harvested. Yeah, it isn't a predator management area, but cougars can be there. But we need to learn to deal with having cougars there. We can't go on with this continual thought that the cougars are the reason we don't have deer. We've got elk. We've got lack of chaining, lack of fires, a million other things that have come into play, and we keep blaming on the cougars. We need to have a safety valve. 40% is not too much to ask of his female sub quota. We do ask that all females are included in this. Currently, with most of their plans, we're only looking at adult females. All females need to be put into the data of the 40% and stuff when they go and figure them calculations, not just the adult females. Sub adults aren't looked at it. We've asked for that. And as a houndsman and as a board, a member of the Utah Houndsman Association, 90% of our hunters right now are using GPS tracking collars. We've requested that GPS coordinates are required on all cougar harvests. It does give the ability for law enforcement to go back in, verify that kill location, make sure that kill actually is there if they have any questions on that. It's not a hardship. The price of a GPS is minimal. If you can't afford that, you're not even close to being able to afford to run a pack of dogs. And anybody that wants to use that excuse is just using the excuse for something besides being truthful and honest and stuff. They're what we ask for. You know, I've been doing this for 30 some odd years. I've watched the ups and downs, been involved in it. Yeah, I'm very, very serious about this. It's a lifestyle. I don't want to see fewer deer. I don't want to see fewer elk, but I damn sure don't want to see fewer lions, what we have. And right now, there is areas in this state that we are on the brink of having a problem where there aren't going to be lions to chase, lions to catch, and lions to harvest. Thank you.
Thanks, Guy. That's the only comment card I had from the audience. We'll go to comments from the rack. Wait, Daryl, you want to say something?
See, we're having female subquota herds when they say that's never been an issue. I don't see that. And if there's these vacuums, then those areas that have a few more will be moving into the areas that don't have them, and that's from them. They're moving out. They're filling niches. I don't see that. And I don't know how you manage any animal or mammal in the state without consideration of the females. I mean, that's your whole ball game right there. The GPS thing, that excuse, being in law enforcement for 30 years, that's your crook, that's your criminal, that's someone's hiding something. And Guy's right, everyone's running GPS, they're all running GPS, so that's a crock. They can do that.
I'll shut up. They've got dogs, they've probably got several GPS.
Well, yeah, they do. They've got $2,000 invested, so I'm not buying that.
I think we seriously, hunters, anglers, houndsmen have a high degree of knowledge as to population. So I think we really need to take into consideration the recommendations made by the Utah Houndsmen Association. My only comment.
I have a question, just to make sure I'm clear what we're doing tonight.
Yes, sir.
We're looking at what is going to happen in 2015. We're not looking at changing the management plan, except that from this after 2015, we will be going through this setting objectives every single year.
Well, the entire Cougar management plan will be revisited.
Of every year.
Let me clarify that what we are asking is that you ask that we reopen the Cougar plan, and the Cougar Advisory Committee through that plan will come back with a recommendation. It may or may not be annually. That was a misrepresentation there. What we're asking is we come back next year, that what we're proposing tonight is just for 1 year.
That is what I want to be clear on. We're not.
This is going to be the easiest question you answer on.
Okay.
I just was looking at the advisory board.
Uh-huh.
And this advisory board, most of them aren't quite like this, but this is, I went through the whole thing. I don't know them all, but I know who they are. And you've got to have your division people there. This board is all special interest group.
Okay.
If you look at it. Mm-hmm. There's not anybody on this one that is not representing some special interest. And I mm-hmm. think that's unusual for most of these people.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So uh-huh. I'm just wondering, I mean, why are we looking at this? It does seem a little odd. I mean, I sort of understand it, but we have had this cougar fight. I'm sure you're sick of it, too, because you've been here for every one of them. But is it because we have these special interest groups on this group that are just kind of bickering and we're not really making headway here, or what's going on?
Yeah,
why can't we make a decision and stick with like a 3-year?
Yeah, I'm really shocked. I thought we had an agreement with the Utah Houndsmen Association, you know, as of 2 days ago. And I thought that, with the people we've been working with, I thought that it was there. But I don't know what the problem is other than that they're a diverse group themselves. Mm-hmm. People from different parts
and
of the
all
state.
Have differing opinions.
Yeah. But I think as far as cougar management, the way I would like to go into it with the next Cougar Advisory Board, this doesn't necessarily mean that these are going to be the same people on the committee. We need to have all facets of cougar management represented, which include deer, which include, bighorn sheep and things like that. So, and the general hunter. So, yeah, we'll look at that. Okay. Look at the makeup.
Good luck.
And thanks.
Any other comments from the RAC? Entertain a motion.
Take a crack at it.
All right.
I'll say we take the plan with these additions that you add the sub quota 40% back in, so there's some protection for the females, and you take into account the females harvested in your calculations. It's only
all. You mean all females?
Right.
Okay.
And I would just like to clarify that we did.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Okay.
And the GPS, that's a no-brainer. Let's put the GPS in there too. Houndsmen should be able to come up with a GPS location to assist law enforcement and their biologists to know where the harvests are. That's where I'm at. You got that?
I'll try. I'll try. Everybody understand that?
I actually don't understand it.
Okay.
Okay, you said 40%
put your
quota.
Sub-quota back in.
Okay,
sub-quota.
On which units?
On the quoted units?
Yeah.
On
not your limited entry.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking
not
for. And not on predator management plan units.
No, on all quoted units.
Okay. Even, but they, you also want it on a predator management plan unit?
Yeah.
Okay, that's not our objective on a predator management plan unit, though.
Well, I understand where you're going there, but I have a really hard time accepting that you're on this kill everything program. I understand you want to reduce them, but I don't think that's good science, Bill.
Okay.
I'm not going to go there. I'm just not going to do it.
Todd?
Sir?
I hate to do this, but there is a female sub-quota on predator management units last year. Documentation right here, right off of the website, how many it is. So yes, there is female sub-quota on predator management units.
But it's at a different level.
Bill, it's right there.
No,
do you know the percentage, Guy, or can you?
Female harvest remaining, 17. On that particular one, that is a female sub quota.
The reason.
Do you know the percentage on those? Is there a percentage level on a predator management unit?
I don't dare say just without one I've got to run the figure.
Okay.
I'll have to look at
that.
Okay.
If you want me to take the paper.
I know, Brad, you're shaking your head. Can you help out here?
I think what you've got is some of the units within the UNIS are under cougar management, some of them are under predator management.
Bighorn management still, because there's no quota.
I'm going to have to do some more research on that. But
I'm not saying your sheep units. I understand. You want them all gone. I guess we have to live with some of them, but I don't think you can annihilate a population and feel good about it, feel right about
we're
it.
Not planning on
I know you say that, and then you sit there and tell me that it doesn't matter because you never hit it anyway. So look me in the eye and just tell me why it matters so much to you. Because you're not telling me. I feel like I'm at Congress and watching freaking C-SPAN. You're not answering.
I don't know why I'm not answering. Daryl, I honestly don't believe our management plan is going to.
Let's just go to this. I'm not changing it for him. It's how I stated it. I really don't care at this point. There's got to be some protection, something. I know they want the numbers down to put it down there, but you've got to have something.
Okay, so let me try and restate it for so that we can. Well, do I need a second, or do you want me to restate it
go
so
ahead,
that we can?
You got it.
Okay. You would like to accept the proposal as presented with the following caveats. add in the female subquota of 40%, consider all females in the harvest, and require a GPS.
Right. That's it. All I want is the 40%.
Yeah. And the 40%, let's... That's not in the bighorn sheep units or the limited entry units.
No.
All other units.
Right.
Okay.
I'll second that.
Seconded by Trish. Is there any discussion on the motion?
Well, I have some discussion. But
okay.
Just a quick comment, because I'm going to vote against it, but you probably wouldn't be able to come up with a proposal I would vote for, because I am adamantly opposed to pursuit hunts. We don't pursuit hunt deer. We don't pursuit hunt elk. I don't believe we should pursuit hunt any animal. And other than that, so I'm going to vote against it.
Any other discussion on the motion?
No.
All in favor? Those opposed? Wayne opposed. Motion passes.
Okay, are you ready to move on?
Next one, number 8, fur bearer and bobcat harvest recommendations. Is this you again, Leslie?
Yeah, I'm still Leslie.
Okay.
Not a lot to talk about with this tonight. In the Bobcat plan, we have 4 different performance targets that we look at. Those are the percent young adult females, percent adult females, percent adult survival, and the set days per Bobcat. I think I jumped ahead of myself right there. And this last year, we were able to meet the targets in 3 of those performance targets. The percent juveniles rose to 46%, adult survival was 70%, which is within the target. Percent females was right at the upper level of the target. And then the set days per bobcat, even though it was outside of the performance target, it's still trending in the right direction. And so according to the Bobcat plan that was put together, if 2 or more of the performance targets are outside of the range, then we return to baseline. What it means, if we're meeting, what we did is we met 3 of the performance targets. So what we're doing is we're returning to where we started, where we were at when we initiated the Bobcat plan. And so what we're recommending this year is to have 6 permits per individual. And let's go back over here. The season runs from the 3rd Wednesday in November to the 2nd Sunday in February, and no cap on tags sold. And I guess we'd already talked about this tonight, so this is no surprise to you. No changes on any other fur bearer seasons. You know, just for your information, beaver and mink will run from September 27th to April 7th. Badgers, kit fox, gray fox, ringtail, spotted skunk, and weasels will go till February 2nd. The same with marten. And that's it. So hopefully that one isn't quite as controversial.
I'm not there yet.
Uh-oh.
The only question how you jump from 3, and I'm not opposed, I want to hear from the trappers, because I don't trap. So I'll go there, but you went from 3 and a cap to basically wide open.
Yeah.
Is this not a little bit scary?
It's really scary.
So can you tell us why you did?
Oh, man. You know, Daryl, I'm caught tonight in kind of a really tough situation with both the cougar and the fur bear recommendations because, you know, being a former mammals coordinator, I would have done things different. And we've talked in the agency that this is a big step. And, yeah, there's some of us in the agency that are really worried that it's too much. But this is what the plan says. The plan was passed by the Wildlife Board. You know, the coordinators and the people that were in place when it went in, you know, they had good justifications for what they did. But I personally think that that's a little bit of an oversight, that we should have incrementally worked back to the baseline would have been my recommendation.
It looks like, Bill, and the variables last year, 2013, every single one of them was outside the target. And then this
well,
year...
Well, percent survival was within. It's
no,
within
it's that. 65 to oh, 72, no, it was, and it well, was
yeah,
75.
But it was actually over. I mean,
yeah.
It was higher, so that was it was actually okay to be higher than the target. That's
so
good.
That's why you have it, I mean, limited last year, right? It's because mm-hmm. you've got the right. variables outside.
Yeah, I have to be honest, I'm going to be interested to see what the trappers say about mm-hmm. the populations, if it can sustain this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, I have to be honest, too. You know, we've referred to it a little bit tonight, but we had kind of a fiasco on October 1st when we sold our bobcat permits. We had the cap of 4,600. And we made the mistake of putting the price in as $15 per permit, where it was $15 if you'd have bought the three permits. Mm-hmm. And that still would have sold out in 17 minutes. And we ended up with 900 errors. I'm on the error committee. And so every one of those, we had to go through each one of those one at a time and evaluate whether we were going to give them permits. How many more permits could we get? Were we going to refund? What were we going to do? And I think we came to pretty good resolution, but it was kind of a disaster. If we open this up to unlimited this year, I can't really tell you how many we're going to sell.
I just have visions of the law liners again and everything else.
That's why we have this process, to get the input. So.
Can you explain what those percentages are coming from or how they're derived?
Okay, the percent juveniles... when we check in a bobcat, you know, the trapper tells us, was it an adult or was it a juvenile? We also take the jaw, and we can look at the jaw and determine for ourselves by the growth on the tooth whether that was a juvenile or an adult. Percent survival, what we do is we section a subset of the teeth, and we just create what they call the life insurance business is a mortality curve. It creates a life table, and from that we're able to calculate percent survival. Because what we do is we get an age for every animal. So if you just think of, just look at it, the different ages, how many are surviving per year? There's a mathematical model that does that. Then percent females, that's reported by the trappers themselves. Set days per bobcat. We have a questionnaire we send out to everybody who has a fur bearer license and ask them, how many animals did you catch? How many sets did you have out? How many days did you trap? And so that's where those come from.
Thank you. We are questions from the rack. Are there any other questions from the rack?
So bobcats buy insurance?
I think I need to.
They better this year. Questions from the audience.
Harvey Howard, Bill, has the DWR ever done any studies on bobcats and their effect on deer fawns?
Not specifically. We've had two different bobcat projects during my career. Jim Karpowitz, when he was in graduate school, he studied bobcats up at Diamond Fork Canyon, and then Boyd Blackwell studied them out on the Sheep Rocks. I think that, I'd have to go back and look at their studies, but I don't really recall that fawns were a significant portion of their diet. There may be, there's obviously occasions when it happens, but it wouldn't be a significant portion.
Okay. That's all for questions.
Okay.
Again, I'm Brandon Payne, representing myself as a trapper. Do you know what years they had unlimited bobcat tags in the past?
Oh, I think it was, I wish I would have brought that table with me. I think it was 2006. Do you have the table right there?
Yeah, but it doesn't give us the number of tags that was issued. 2006 and 7 was the highest harvest.
I believe that, okay. Looking at this and recalling what I looked at the table itself, I would say that 2003 through 2006 2007 is when it was unlimited.
When it was unlimited. So 2003 to 2006 or 7.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay. That's all I've got right now.
Any other questions from the audience? We'll go to comments. We've got a pretty good stack here. Guy, you want to go first? Guy Webster, followed by David Bronson.
As a houndsman, I don't hunt trap line and stuff, but once again, I think we just need to be a little bit cautious on over-harvesting, going from 3 to 6 tags unlimited. It's just kind of a point where maybe we need to take a little bit smaller step, leave it at 3 and let as many people buy tags as wanting so they don't sell out, or, you know, bring it up to 4 tags or something, but just going unlimited just seems like it's a real scary situation. And this, I'm just speaking for myself, not the Houndsman Association. We really don't have a stand on it. But I just think, you know, let's be a little bit cautious.
You want to go 3, but unlimited
that
way?
We need to do something. I'll take some recommendations from these guys, but just myself, I think that we're just not being real responsible for something that could take a long time to get back if we lose it.
Okay. Thanks, Guy. David Bronson with Brandon Payne next.
Yeah, I don't think when they went to unlimited, the number that's harvested is that much greater than when they had it on a quota. So I support the recommendations that have been made. Thank you.
Brandon Payne with Kent Fowden next.
I'm going to ask you to pass. My name is Brandon Payne. I'm representing myself as a trapper. Quickly, I would like to address the unlimited bobcat tags. If you'd please turn to the back page of that information I gave you. Bill just told us that from roughly 2003-2004 season to the 2006-2007 season, we had unlimited numbers of bobcat tags allocated. If you will look in that time period, the highest trap harvest was in 2006-2007 with 3,037 animals harvested. That equated out to 3 bobcats per trapper. I don't know. Do you know how many tags were allowed per trapper that year?
6.
Okay. So if that was similar scenario to what we're looking at this year with unlimited tags, the 11,000 roughly tags issued, we had a harvest of 3,000 animals. Yeah, it's iffy, but we have 31 years of data here that shows the average over the 31 years is 1.7 bobcats per trapper. It's not, you know, you can look down through there as you have time. Another point I wanted to point out was the only one of the 4 criteria that's not in line is the set days per bobcat. I've highlighted the low set number per days of bobcat at 120. That equated to 1.4 bobcats per trapper. If you look down to the 2010, the set days per bobcat was 481. That still equated to 1.4 bobcats per trapper. I don't think set days per bobcat can be looked at as a very good judge of the bobcat population. I think it more reflects the number of trappers and the number of traps they have set. If you, you know, like I said, as you have time, you can look through this. You'll also notice that there is kind of a consistent curve. You show a high price per pelt 1 year. The next year, the number of trappers increases. It's not drastic. It looks like, just quickly glancing, the highest number of trappers was in 84-85 at 1,253.
No, I take that back. 2008, 2009, there were 1,630. That was the highest number of trappers. They took 1,796 animals. They also had the highest number of set days, meaning they had the highest number of traps out. And that equated also to the highest number of set days per bobcat. So I think there's more of a correlation between the set days per animal in relation to, number one, the amount of trappers in the field, and number two, the amount of equipment they have out that manipulates that. Then back to the first page of this rambling. I'm not 100% sure this is the place to bring it up, but I'm not sure where it is, so I would like to propose that we standardize a trap check to 96 hours on all traps and snares. Right now it's 48 hours for lack of a better term, land traps. Snares, traps that are set so they will drown the animals, say muskrats, raccoons, beavers, stuff like that, are 96 hours. The animals that this would affect are badger, bobcat, coyote, fox, raccoon, ring-tailed, skunks, and weasels. If you look on the second page of this information I gave you, it says the average number of set days per animal of these that I listed above for the 2012-2013 season was 126 days. So that means, on average, a trap sat there for 126 days before it took one of these animals up here. That equated to 63 trap checks per animal. So a trapper was checking a trap 63 times before they caught an animal, basically. If we change that to a 96-hour trap check, that would still be 32 trap checks per animal. People raise the argument, well, the trap check isn't to protect the target species, it's to protect the non-target species. And I would agree with that also. So if you look at page 3 of this information, it lists the animals, fur bearers harvested in traps set for other species. And if we look numbers-wise, the highest number in 2012-2013, again, that was taken incidentally was striped skunk at 1,159. And I've just got the highest three numbers-wise highlighted there.
Brandon, you're running out of time here,
okay.
So.
I'll hurry. Anyway, basically, yeah, it sounds like it's cruel. You're leaving an animal there, you know, two more days in a trap. Realistically, we can't set a trap there, walk away, and an animal comes right in and steps in it, you know. The data the Fish and Game presents, you know, for all of their time studying it, proves that, you know. On average, we're, you know, like I said, 63 times we have to check an empty trap. The reasons for my proposal is, with the pushing of the BMPs, which is that other handout I gave you, which emphasizes equipment, modifications, that type of stuff to hold an animal longer, more comfortably, and the fur harvester education courses, trappers nowadays are better educated, both in equipment, how to prevent catching non-target animals, and a couple other things. Changing the trap check would cut trapper caused human interference in a big game wintering ground, because that's where 90% of predator trapping takes place in the winter. It would cause that human interference, the trapper caused human interference, that would cut it 50%. Another thing, my kids got burned out within the first month. We all live in a instant gratification society. We all get ticked off when our computer's running slow. We're not immune to it, unfortunately. I think it would help keep kids interested. Basically, I'm probably out of time, so anyway, appreciate your time.
Okay, thanks, Brandon. Kent Bowden, you're next. Jerry Swayze on deck.
Kent Fowden, Utah Trappers Association. As a whole, we
are here to support the plan as written. The numbers, the set check, the set day checks, they can be construed in several ways, but I won't go into that. The other number that's get thrown around is the 11,000 tags and things like that. 30 years of data shows that we've never harvested more than 3,400 animals, regardless of the number of tags sold. That's 30 years of hard data. It's undisputable. The other thing I would like to see is a recommendation, and there's reasons why. I'd like to see the board support an increase in the season length, be it on the front end or the back end. If you go to the front end, you're putting more trappers out. They're killing more coyotes. You go to the back end, you can increase the juvenile survivability. Same thing with females. There's a lot of contest either way. Bill will tell you one thing, and it's back and forth. It's back and forth. But you've got 30 years of hard data, and even the biologist would agree with 30 years of hard numbers. So, but as a whole, we support the plan as written. Would support or ask for a vote to extend the season up to 2 weeks, a week. Anything would be beneficial. Thank you.
Kent, can I ask you a question while you're there?
Yes, sir.
Does the Trapper Association, Brandon's proposal about the extending to 96 hours, do you have a position on that? Or
I would like to see that. There's a lot of reasons. There's a misnomer of again with this set days. When you set for a coyote, and I have to be a big coyote trapper, it can take as much as 2 weeks before that trap's ever visited. So there's a lot of things, but I would support that. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jerry Swayze's next with James Butterfield on deck.
I agree with what you've got there for your proposals. I think that New Mexico and Nevada, they both run unlimited tags, and they seem to be holding their population pretty good. So I think we should be relatively the same for the terrain and everything, being next door neighbors basically. And the additional time frame on a season, I think that'd be a good deal. We had it prior to the three tag results. We lost 2 weeks on that when we lost our six tags before. So the 2 weeks would be back to where we was at when we started. And the 96-hour check, 96 or 72, it'd be good, because you find yourself getting farther and farther away from civilization to set your traps, so that you don't end up with a lot of dog catches and stuff like that. So you got some miles put on, so if you had more time to get there, you could probably get farther away and stay out of the harm's way of other animals.
Thanks, Jerry. James Butterfield next, and Sanford Randall following him.
I agree with the guy there about over-trapping areas. Me being the young guy on the block, I'm the guy that they look at saying, make sure you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. That even as young as I am compared to what they are, I still follow the exact law that we talk about in the meetings and at all the conventions, that you trap somewhere for a little while, you catch a few animals, you move. You move somewhere else. If you're not catching in that area, leave it alone for a couple of years. And that's the way I've been taught. And I know that that's the way they teach everybody, even in all the classes. They have classes at every UTA convention I've been to. And so there is a lot of education behind it. There always is going to be those few people that that don't follow, but that's in every form of hunting that I know. There's always going to be those couple of guys that ruin it for all of us. But I support the six tags. It's a lot of work to catch six cats. It's a lot of work. If you're running more than 20 traps, honestly, and doing a good job at it, if you're saying you're running 60 traps and you're not there daylight till dark, you're lying. It's a lot of work. You're talking a trap every 2-3 miles because all the animals aren't going to be all in one area. And you can't landmine an area without somebody finding you out. So trappers are taught to be unseen, unheard. So I don't see a lot of the people changing how many they catch anyway. So if I could catch six cats, that'd be great. Yeah, I know. So that's all I got.
Thanks, James. Sanford, you're next.
I would also support the division's recommendation for the increase in tags and also with the extension of the seasons. A couple of things that does is one, it gets trappers out, especially in our area where we have an issue with coyotes. It gets trappers out to work on those coyotes more and more all the time. The thing with the trap check law that makes that sometimes you can find an area that is that the bobcats are very few, but usually those areas are very close to town because you can't travel out far enough to set traps and keep within your track check area. Where we're from, there's a lot of trap check time. Excuse me. Where I'm at, there's a lot of areas that are very, very inaccessible. And if you have more hours that you can use to check those traps, it gets trappers out into those areas, and it leaves those areas close to town that are they're not worked so hard. And so the populations in those areas, they do better. They don't have near the competition in those areas, and that's the way it is now. In southern Utah, last year you just about couldn't go anywhere that there wasn't a trap because it's the prices were high at the time and there were a lot of trappers out. With the last year, the prices decreased 30% on bobcats. And so the number of trappers that will be out, if you look at the history of the trapping over the years, this year there won't be as many trappers just because of the price drop. And the idea that we're reckless because we're increasing the tags to six, again, the data shows that we've never harvest that many, and so I don't believe it is reckless. And the this is one thing that the analysis that they do with their triggers, it's calling for it, and I also support it.
Thanks. That's all the comment cards we had from the public, so we'll go to one more.
I just like to say that I'm interested in the 96-hour check as well, and I really have no problem with the six-tag deal, but, I would recommend that the RAC or the DWR look at maybe a little better trigger system. To jump it up rather than just doubling it. Obviously, there's a trigger system in place, and that's why it went to six. I don't feel like the areas that my family has trapped have increased in population enough to go clear to six, but, if the triggers and what they put in place, then that's the way it is. So I would look to a little better trigger system possibly. So, anyway, thank you.
Thanks. Okay, let's go to Rack.
I just have a couple. Will this be addressed next year? Is there a trigger? Is there something? I'm not opposed to the six tags. But if the harvest doubles or triples, is there a trigger that this is addressed and shut down?
What we'll do next year is we'll look at where did we fall within these performance targets, and if we need to readjust, we will. So
I mean, in theory, when you look at these statistics, it did double. I mean, or meaning like if they said 2006, it was 3,000 compared to 1,200 this last year. I mean, we kind of know that's probably going to happen, right? Looking at statistics.
Yeah, and doubling of the harvest may not be a problem as long as it falls within the population parameters.
Right. Okay. No, that's good.
Bill, once you hit two of the target criteria, that's when you go back to base.
Baseline. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we've got three that are in the target right now, so, and one trending. So...
So we should be at baseline?
Just saying. I'd entertain a motion. You've kind of got, if you want to address, you know, you've kind of got three things there. You've got the number of permits. You've got the 48-hour versus 96-hour, and then the unlimited deal. Oh, the season length. So I don't know if you want to address any of those separately.
I can't go for the 96 hours. I lost a $3,000 lion dog in a set of traps. I found her dead. Trapper hadn't even checked his trap. You know, she cost more than he was going to harvest all year. And that's an incidental catch. And there's a lot of people out with dogs. I just, you know, I trap for years and years and years. If you're going to trap, you need to check your traps. But other than that, I have no issue with the proposal DWR has. And this isn't part of it.
Is that a motion, Daryl?
I make a motion we accept the DWR's proposal. That's it.
I'll second it.
So we've got a motion by Daryl, second by Blair, to accept the Fur Bear and Bobcat recommendations as presented. Any discussion on the motion? All in favor? Any opposed?
I don't like it, but not for
you. You snuck in there on the in favor. You snuck in on the in favor.
When we look at trapping for animals like this, we're looking at the wrong kind of thing. We're not looking at really what's going on in an area. There are too many other things that should be played into this, like. What's the rat population? Do we want cats or rats? Is sort of what. So, you know, doubling these things, this is like, it's playing the wrong game.
How did you vote, Wayne? How did you vote, Wayne?
Well, you know, I guess I'll vote against this because I'm okay. Not looking at it right.
Okay. So we had one opposed, Wayne. Motion passes.
Yeah, I shouldn't change.
I believe that's it. We're adjourned.